Starting a second track, we made a move to a quieter location. And if I recall, we were Paul was discussing the major changes that were occurring at the time that he was with Canadian International Grains Institute. And one of those major ones was the consolidation and dismantling, actually, of the country elevator system. And I think your last comment had to do with the internationalization of the Canadian grain trade. So do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, exactly. And not just the Canadian grain trade, but as I think back on it, for example, we saw the same kind of thing happening in the flour milling industry. There was quite a change that took place in the flour milling industry with major players from the U.S. Is that working all right here?
Yep.
With major players in the U.S. taking a very big position in the Canadian flour milling industry. So that happened. And also we saw concentrations in malting, in the malting industry in Canada as well, with more international participation. And as well in the brewing industry. So all of these things took place as globalization was the big force driving all of this. And big players found opportunities to move into other markets, including the Canadian markets, and add on components to their worldwide positions, their worldwide holdings. And that continued apace throughout this period. So it wasn't just the concentration in the grain handling system, but also in those other aspects of the grain industry.
Right, and again, if history serves me, I think it was the mid-80s where the globalization...
And the free trade.
The free trade agreement.
The agreement as well. So we were open for business, and we were open to participate globally, and others were open to come and take... greater participation in the Canadian industry. Mm.
Did Canada, in turn, the Canadian industry, take greater participation in international companies?
Not to the same extent. And I think that really there hasn't evolved yet a big, strong Canadian international company, with Richardson exception, of course, but and they're doing very well. But they're still essentially a Canadian-based operation, not an internationally. They don't span the globe in quite the same way that Cargill or ADM or Bunge or Dreyfus or any of the really big players do, or Glencore at this point. So that's something that's highly observable, is that we didn't end up with a great, huge Canadian, international, multinational based here in Canada. And I suppose the question of where the national base or loyalty is for companies is an open one, because international companies work worldwide. They are domiciled in sometimes the strangest places that don't seem to make a lot of sense, but probably do from a structural accounting and other point of view. And they're international players, and they're not necessarily rooted in one place or another. But for those of us who grew up during the Canadian Wheat Board era and who worked during the Canadian Wheat Board era and watched all of this change, there are certainly... for questions about, well, why couldn't there be a Canadian worldwide champion as well in the grain industry? But so far it hasn't come to pass.
Now, these changes, and they've only accelerated after the time that you left the Canadian Wheat Board, so the 2000s, mm-hmm. from 2000-2010. What kind of impact during your time with Canadian Institute or International Grains Institute, the increased presence of international companies in Canada, did that have any impact on the work that was done within Canadian International Grains Institute? And the Wheat Board,
you know,
because they're so closely associated.
No, not hugely. And you mentioned an important part, and that is that our founding tenant, our core tenant in the whole Canadian Grain Institute institution, was the Canadian Wheat Board. And so long as the Canadian Wheat Board was there, there was sort of a strong, steady, solid base of funding support, for example, which was critical and important, but also of direction, that there wasn't a big change there. The international companies have their own ideas about market development. I think they're quite comfortable and happy doing their own work, and they would not necessarily discourage Canadian participation in overseas markets, but, for example, they might say that, well, there's really no need for Canada to do a whole lot of development work over in Korea, because we already have people over there. We have our company people are representing us there, and they're looking after everybody's interests, so don't worry, be happy, and we'll all carry on. And so there wasn't any particular push or drive that there should be particularly a Canadian presence, because it might suit the company to source grain, for example, in other places. And so there wouldn't have been the same incentive and the same kind of drive that would have been there before. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think it's the Canadian International Grains Institute was quick to recognize that the landscape had changed, made the adjustments required, worked with all the players, the new international players, and the new form and the new landscape rather well. They adapted, having again still the anchor tenant in the house, who was the Canadian Wheat Board at the time.
Now, when you say the anchor tenant, was most of the education that was done with wheat and barley, which were their major products, or did the International Grains Institute programs cover also other products such as canola,
Actually, it was broader than just wheat and barley. They were two very important parts, components, absolutely. But it did include pulses and other crops. We did have canola programs as well. So it had a much broader appeal and broader coverage than just the wheat board grains, the wheat and the barley.
When you think back on the time, the 14 years that you spent there, other than the changes that you've already talked about, and challenges, are there any that come to mind, specific issues that arose that needed to be dealt with beyond the really big changes?
Yeah, not in particular. I think we always were flexible, adaptable, and accommodated the changes as we went forward, because we were essentially providing a service to the grain industry. And so there were no really insurmountable difficulties that I can think of that we were not able to accommodate. But one of the things that happened for me, and I didn't mention to you earlier that I'd been involved in the founding of a biotechnology company. And one of the drivers for that was that I felt that wouldn't it be nice if we could have a biotechnology company in Canada, in Winnipeg in particular, my home city. That could add value to Canadian crops. That would be a Canadian company in Winnipeg that would have the opportunity to create really good jobs, science and technology jobs. That could be the foundation of a participant in a biotechnology sector here in Manitoba, which was just beginning, which has had some success, and I wanted to be part of that. And this was partly, in my mind, an effort was partly in response to all the changes that I could see taking place around me, because I was concerned about the old head office argument that what were we going to do? We would simply be left here as the traditional hewers of wood and drawers of water, and that all the good jobs would be in the head offices located somewhere else, that the science and technology would all be done somewhere else, that the patent work would all be done somewhere else, and that we would lose all of these things, or at least we wouldn't gain them. So that the changes that took place at a personal level affected me to that extent that I went out and, with another, co-founded a biotechnology company, which is gone on to be a successful protein company and is now, as I say, a publicly traded company listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange.
Now, I can't recall did we if we have the name
of
that company.
The name is Burcon. B-U-R-C-O-N, Burcon Nutriscience.
B-E-R?
B-U-R-C-O-N. Now, that's not the name of our original company.
Okay.
But we eventually made arrangements with them to commercialize the product.
So what was the name of your original company?
It was BMW Canola.
And how did you pick that particular product to work with?
Well, two things. One is that I got a family connection with it. My uncle, Balder Stephenson, is the so-called, together with Keith Downey, the father of canola. So I was always very much aware of canola, and so anything to do with canola, I was alive to and alert to. And the second thing is that I attended a Canada Grains Council meeting in April of 1991, and I heard a presentation given by Don Murray about value-added opportunities for Canadian crops. And he talked in that presentation about the fact that we had a technology that would isolate pure canola protein from canola meal, and that canola protein was a very good functional and nutritional protein. And he identified that as one of a number of opportunities. So at the end of his presentation, I approached him and said, I'd like to hear more. One thing led to another, and I said, I'd like to try and commercialize this. He is a protein chemist by training, and probably one of Canada's best in his field, without a doubt. And so he agreed to work with me, and he would support me technically, and that I would do the rest, pushing all this stuff uphill for a long time to see if we couldn't commercialize this product. And so that's what happened. We ended up taking it forward from the test tubes to the pots and pans to the bathtubs and to the various quantities as you move along the whole development scaling up process. And then we finally reached a point where it was just too much for us. We didn't have the resources to go to the mini pilot scale. And that's when we looked around for partners, and that's when the Burcon people came and said, we like this idea, we'll join forces with you. And we ended up making arrangements with them to commercialize the product, which is now underway, and we're happy with the result.
Where is Burcon from?
Burcon is a company based in Vancouver. It is registered in Whitehorse. What's that? In the Yukon. It's the Yukon, and the reason it's registered there is because that allows they allow international. International people, not necessarily residents of Canada, to be on boards and on their board of directors to hold positions at the company. And I'm not sure I'm quite right about holding positions, but yes, probably I am. In any event, behind all of this was a Hong Kong company that was very interested in becoming involved in this sector in North America. So that's where that all came from.
And what are the uses of the canola protein?
Well, it has many uses in food products and in small quantities. Of many prepared and processed food products in the stores, in the supermarkets, contain small amounts of protein, most of it now soy, and we've now shifted to soy because soy has become a more current opportunity for us than the canola. But it goes into all manner of food products, whipping and baked goods, into processed goods, into meat products, into a great number,
and
shakes and drinks. And
is it possible to explain to a layperson such as me what the chemical composition of that protein, what it does, both the soy and the canola, what's its main contributor, what function it contributes to those products you just mentioned?
Well, the function, from a functional point of view, the proteins provide you with the ability to whip, to gel, to foam, to emulsify products. So it's like, I think the easiest example would be like food glue. If you want something to hold together, like a mass that's not, it's like a reinforcement. It's like egg white. Egg white is probably is the gold standard, and a very highly functional protein. And so that I think that gives you an idea. If you think of meringue pies and you think of eggs that you put into, well, this protein, eggs of course are not vegetable based; they are animal based. So this is the proteins that we've been extracting from canola and from soy and now from peas. We've added peas as well. Perform these kinds of functions. So food scientists use these things in food systems to make better products, and it goes across a whole range of different consumer products.
Now, would price be the major decision maker in whether you use any of those? Well, even if you choose pea over canola, over soy, or over egg, what determines which ones the manufacturers would choose?
I think that performance would come first, and so they will look for something that's going to do the job, because great many the big food companies that provide most of the food that we see in one form or another on the shelves, they have a product and a reputation and a brand to protect and defend. So they're not going to take any chances with oddball kinds of configurations and things. So they need tried, true, tested ingredients to go into their products. They will be looking also at the economics. Their egg white, for example, is wonderful stuff. Two problems, I guess, with egg white from their perspective. One is it's usually very expensive. Two is it's animal-based rather than vegetable-based. And as you know, health, wellness, nutrition, shifting from animal-based products to vegetable-based products. And so our soy, pea, and canola products fit very well into that shift and trend.
Do they, in turn, those three, do they have different when you put them into products, do they react slightly differently, or are they interchangeable?
Somewhat interchangeable, but have different properties, and some better at some things than other things.
Okay.
And also, from a nutritional point of view, they're going to have different profile. Nutritional profile will be different, is different. I mean, for example, canola has high, we've got two products there. One is high in cysteine, which is one of the amino acids. They're chains of amino acids, these proteins. And I'm not the protein expert here, but I do know that canola has a couple of very strong features. One is this high cysteine content. The other is methionine is high as well. So taken all together, it's a very good quality protein for human consumption. Soy has a different composition, and it's also very good, and peas as well. So they each have their own strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Strengths, I suppose we can say. And it is the case that if you combine them from a nutritional point of view, the sum is greater than just the sum of the parts. The value is greater than just the sum of the parts. Because whatever shortfall there might be in one in terms of an amino acid can be made up from another. So there's a balancing and a compensation effect when you bring them together. And so that's part of the story. And the other is their rates of digestibility are different. So that means you could have sort of a long, you could have one of them may have a very big burst of digestibility at the beginning of a certain time period, and the other didn't kick until later. And that's true in terms of the mixes of proteins. So from a nutritional point of view, it's exciting, it's interesting, and very timely, because people want to live better, eat better, live longer, be healthy. So these products address many of those desires and requirements.
So when you started, you were working with the canola protein extraction.
Yeah.
And then you expanded to the other two. Why did you expand to the other twos? Was it just for what you were saying, that they could combine to make a better product, or were there other reasons behind?
All of the above, and also we wanted to diversify. We didn't want to be just a one-trick pony kind of company. So we had the canola, we know how to make it, going down that track. We added the soy, and we added the peas. And their technology, I mentioned that their nutritional profile is different, so is their chemical composition. So that required major modification of the process, et cetera. And so there are processes particular to those, using some of the similar techniques, obviously. But so we wanted to diversify. That was the one thing. The other thing is that canola protein is not yet established as a category. There's a lot of interest in it. One day it will be. I'm sure it has a lot of great features, and we will probably be the ones. We expect to be the ones who will finally do that. But soy has been around for 66 years. Peas have been around for a very long time. So once we had those products ready to go, that was a far easier thing for us to do in terms of commercializing in the markets, because we weren't creating a whole new category. We were just adding a new product to an existing lineup of products within the soy category and within the pea category.
So the process, you had talked about one of the reasons that you wanted to look for something such as this that you could work on is because you were looking for a homegrown product that could be developed in Canada, patented in Canada, and so on. So do those three processes, or the one process that's used for the three different products, those are patented in Canada, that process is?
Yes, and they are three different processes, really. And, you know, there would be some common elements, but not too many, because their properties are different. And this gets into an area that I'm not really all that familiar with. But because I'm the lay person, and Don was the technical expert, and now of course we have a whole team devoted to that. Now the question again you were asking about
is whether it's a Canadian process, whether it accomplished what you hoped it would accomplish.
That's an interesting story, because the journey has taken a different direction at this point. And that is that I looked for, initially stepping back to when we reached the point where Don and I could no longer fund this with our milk money. We were writing checks out of family incomes, and, you know, first it was hundreds, and then it was 500, and then it was thousands. All of this was coming out of a normal family income. So you can't really do a heck of a lot of R&D of normal family income, but we did what we could. And we carried this for a long time by ourselves, but we reached the point where we couldn't do the mini pilot program without major serious resources, and we needed a few million dollars, and we just didn't have it. So we went around to the sources that we thought might be available here in Canada, and knocked on the doors, and went to see the Ensis, and went to see the Crocus, and went to see all these various players, and talked to local people. And in the end, there really wasn't any interest from these Canadian sources, initially in the Canadian sources, in getting involved in a project at this very early stage of development. They would be interested and have the opportunity now to participate, because they can buy the shares in the stock market. But at that point, I mean, it was an idea. They'd looked quite promising, and here we had these two guys who were putting it forward, and it all looked very good, but it was very early stage. So there really wasn't any early stage interest. Finally, the interest came from this group in Hong Kong, who said, we are looking for an opportunity in this field, in this so-called biotechnology field. But that's changed too, because biotechnology now means genetic modification, but we're not genetic modification, we're food technology. Anyway, so they decided that they were prepared to put up the money required to take the next steps, and that's how we did this, how we made these arrangements and did this deal. But in terms of the Canadian part of this, we have here in Winnipeg a technical center for Burcon Nutriscience, and it has 12 or 14 people working in it and have been working in it since 1999. Yes, since 1999. Even before that, we had a small group, because Don and I got the original center up. And then with the efforts of our friends and resources of our friends in Hong Kong and Vancouver, we were able to expand it into what it is today, which is a high-tech research center for protein technology. And it's based right here in Winnipeg. And we've just won a big award at the Las Vegas International Food Technology Show through our partner. We have a partner now, ADM, the big giant food and grain and agriculture company, is our commercialization and development partner. And they have just won an award, and we have just won the award for the, I forget what the designation is, but it's an award-winning product. So, and that comes right out of here, so I'm pretty pleased about that.
I could see
but
why.
The thing about it is that originally I thought that we might have the factory here, and I could sort of visualize all of that happening, and we'd have all these circles around it, and it would be just a beehive of buzzing activity. Didn't quite work out like that. We do have some Canadian presence and results. This technical center is still going full blast and doing very good work and continues to support the projects. We have the small office in administrative office in Vancouver, so that's the Canadian piece. We have Canadian shareholders and so on. But the reality is that when you do come to commercialize products like this, where do you go? Who has the ability to take products like this worldwide? Well, you wind up eventually going to the very big players because they're the ones who have the worldwide established networks. So all they have to do is take our product and put it on the truck. And so instead of them shipping 14 different ingredients to that plant down the road, now it's 15. They put one more bag or one more bulk on the truck, and that's it. So that means that all those, the sort of do-it-yourself, build-it model that I originally visualized really doesn't work in today's environment. It's just not part of the game. Globalization, everything is big. The other thing that's important, and I think our people in Vancouver recognize this as they went through the exercise, is big wants to deal with big. The big customer for ADM, whatever that might be, and these are the people whose names are on the products on the shelves, they want to buy from other big, well-established ingredient suppliers like ADM.
So you were talking about big likes to deal with big, which I think is a very...
Big likes to deal with big, and so we discovered that at the end of the day, we were going to do a deal with one of the big companies. And those big companies are virtually without exception either based in the U.S. or internationally in Europe, or perhaps now in the future in Southeast Asia. So there wasn't really an opportunity to go to a great, big, strong international company in Canada and say, let's go and market this worldwide, because they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. So the closest would be Richardson's?
Richardson's, exactly. And you know, they're a wonderful company and a great company. But they're not operating at the same sort of worldwide mega level that the others are operating. They don't have plants located in six different continents around the world and 80,000 employees and those kinds of things. And they don't have that. They're a great big strong Canadian-based company. Mm-hmm. Maybe they will in the future. You never know.
Yeah.
But they're not there now.
Yeah, I share your both. Well, I share your desire to have Canada become more of a player internationally in the marketplace, rather than being shopped out by
well,
by others.
The Australians call us the branch plant economy, because I think they're thinking more about the mining industry, whereby our big mining giants went the same way as many of our big national grain entities. So that seems to be the Canadian way, and I guess we can wring our hands about it, and I'm not happy about it. I mean, one of the things that drove me to consider doing what I did was to see if I couldn't do something. Mm-hmm. And I did something, but it wasn't quite what I had in mind. It didn't quite work out, but maybe we're talking here about the immutable forces of globalization, that these things are just so enormous that the big players just dominate the field. And as we discovered, our little company discovered, trying to do anything other than go the way we went and cooperate, and we've got great partners in ADM. Wouldn't say anything but good things about that company. They're just wonderful partners for us. They also have a big presence in Canada. It's not like they're not doing anything here. They're doing lots here. Mm-hmm. Are they based in Canada as a world entity? No, they're somewhere else. Our product, the canola products and the soy and the pea products, are they likely to be made here in Canada ultimately? Probably not. They're probably going to fit better into the worldwide program for another company in the U.S. or in Europe or somewhere else, and they'll be sourced from there. So I really don't know how to do this, how to create the Canadian giant company here. But maybe Richardson's are on their way to doing that. I mean, that could well be. They could be adding pieces as we speak all over the world. Maybe they're involved in the Black Sea region. Maybe they're putting up houses in Southeast Asia. Maybe they're doing all of these things.
Yeah. Because, as you mentioned early on, one of the reasons that you were looking at that was you like to have, in your home community, you like to have well-paid people, world renowned in their field, working in your city.
That's what we wanted to do. We wanted to build that right here. That was going to be the hub.
Yeah.
But so far, it didn't quite work out that way. However, looking on the other side of it, we've had this technical center running now for 12 years, 13 years, and that's been, I would say, we are a world, our group is on the leading edge. We have 400 patents worldwide, and we are highly respected and well regarded in that field. And so we pretty well know what we're doing in that area. How that's going to play out in the future, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Where products will be produced and who will ultimately benefit from all of this, we don't know. It's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
But we've already benefited to some extent, and we will continue to be players, but not quite the way I had originally visualized.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have you connected with Agritech International.
Yes, yes.
And when did you slip that into your busy life?
That happened after I left the Canadian International Grains Institute.
So that would have been in 2000 or 2001?
Yeah, 2000. So 2001, let's say. I was always of the opinion that we could do more. And this was during my time at the Wheat Board. In particular, I kept saying to myself, well, you know, this is wonderful that we're selling wheat and barley and doing all these things around the world, but could we not use this platform to do other things? Could we not use the Canadian Wheat Board to be the engine of growth and development in Western Canada? Could it not make investments around the world and own facilities in China, own facilities in various places? And could it not make investments in the Chinese brewing industry? They were begging us to make investments in the Chinese brewing industry. The opportunity we had to be investors in one of the main companies in China was just begging. That company alone is now bigger than the entire Canadian market. So, I mean, they're just enormous opportunities, in my view, that we did not take advantage of. And it's nobody's fault. It wasn't it wasn't part of the mandate of the organization, although that's not even clear because the mandate included the opportunity to do anything that we thought was in the interests of producers. So if Western producers, for example, could have owned a major brewery in China today, would they be happy campers or not? I don't know. I suspect they would. So those were the things that were running in my mind. And the other thing is that the people we were selling the wheat and the barley to, they needed all the technology for handling, receiving, and storage of grain. So my thought was, you know, why don't we sell them some silos? Why don't we sell them some grain cleaners? Why don't we use the Wheat Board platform to do that? It was never really part of the equation. It just didn't compute. It wasn't part of the thinking at the time. So when I left that whole outfit, I said to myself two things. One is I said, well, you know, you've been talking about this for years. Why don't you do something about it? And the doing something about it was creating BMW Canola that led to Burcon, that led to the whole story we just talked about. And the other part of it was to say, well, you know, Agritech is a group of companies based here in Winnipeg that had been responsible for building most of the new facilities in Western Canada. We were, that group of companies was the latest, greatest, highest technology, most experienced in the world in building modern grain facilities. Why wouldn't we take them international? Why wouldn't we just go and offer those services turnkey basis to others around the world who, if they don't buy from us, will buy from somebody else? So why would we waste this opportunity? So I said, you know what, we're not going to do that. And I approached the Agritech people. There was a skeleton organization. They made some efforts in the past, and it hadn't really been highly successful. And so they were impressed with my presentation and what I had done, and I think in particular the fact that I had founded this technology company gave them some confidence that I could do what I said I thought I could do. And they said, sure, okay, we'll go with you, we'll work with you. So I took over the Agritech group of companies. We went international, and we made some attempts in China, which didn't work out. There were some complications there, and lots of people have found difficulty getting traction in China. Anyway, timing just didn't work for us. We shifted gears and went to Russia and went to Kazakhstan, two areas where they have similar grain economies, not grain economies, but grain environment than we, as do we. And so we thought there might be some opportunities there. So I got on an airplane, and Russia was interesting, but it was a time when the Russians had great difficulty making decisions about projects, and so we ran to a number of dead ends there and decided we weren't getting anywhere, so let's try somewhere else. So the somewhere else was Kazakhstan. I went to Kazakhstan, and we have now built more grain storage in Kazakhstan than any other company, period. And so we've now built 5, 6, 7 installations. We've got probably 350,000-400,000 tons of storage, which is roughly half of, not quite half of Vancouver, to put it in perspective, as inland terminals across Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is virtually identical to Canada, where we were working, northern Kazakhstan, to the western prairies. They have the same crops, the same frost-free days, the same weeds, the same everything. And it's just an enormous, endless plain like it is here. So everything fit. It was absolutely a perfect fit. So we built that and happily worked on projects there until the financial crisis of 2008, when everything fell down. Not our structures. They're still standing in good use. But the financing fell down, and they ran into huge problems and haven't really recovered. They've had a couple of really bad crops. But so that's where the Agritech piece fits in, and I'm still working with them, and we're looking for opportunities, and we will do more.
So besides the grain storage, you said there are how many companies involved with the sort of
Agritech? 6 companies here in Winnipeg. And they're the ones who have built most of the new inland grain terminals in Western Canada, the ones that replaced the country elevators, the wooden country elevators. So
Besides the silos, then what other?
Cleaning and handling and receiving and drying equipment, all the pieces you need for an integrated turnkey facility. So we have a construction design build company, engineering company. We have conveyors, a company that makes conveyor systems. We have a company that makes the bins, the big steel bins. We have companies that make the dryers and the other components that we need.
So the scales
projects.
And scales, all of those as well?
Although strange, yeah, we have a scale company, but it never works because they always have their own scales in the country. In the case of Kazakhstan, they want to use their own scales, and I think it's because they maybe trust their scales, or they're familiar with their scales, or they've got a certain idea in mind. Anyway, so we don't do scales, but everything else we've done.
Unfortunate that 2008 came about for many reasons, which I will discuss with you once we're finished the tape for our project. So looking to the future then with that company, what are you sort of hoping?
Southeast Asia, economy is on fire. Less so today maybe than it was a year ago, but it seems like that's where we need to go. And I'm looking at opportunities in that area, and we'll be heading over there soon to see if we can't find an opportunity for Agritech to do some more international work there.
Now, your marketing, you're back to marketing. Well, you were never really, I guess, out of marketing.
Really
you're back
left.
To
you're left marketing. Yeah.
So the connections that you built way back in, you know, starting back in 1970, has there been an opportunity to sort of, as time went by, to just build on and attach to the connections that you made early on in your career?
Yes. I've brought in some of the same people who used to be our customers. Now work for us, Agritech, as consultants to help us with this, this, and this. So the network is alive and well and is working. And so all the investment that we made, that I made in the past.
If Justin Lewis is in the library.
For you.
So all the investment we made in those relationships in the past have been extremely useful. And that's how it works. And you maybe don't see people for a long time, but you keep some kind of relationship up. And then you say, well, can you help us with this over here? And sure, and very often the answer is yes, and they're happy to renew acquaintance and get involved in new projects. Mm-hmm. So this has been and continues to be just a really exciting journey for me. I also think that opportunities for young people now in our field are enormous. We are 9 billion people coming up, probably. Canada is in a great position to be a major player in satisfying food needs for all of those people, both here and abroad. We have the technology, we have the know-how, we have the ambition, we have the people. It's all opportunity there just waiting for us to take it and to pick it up and move forward. And when you think about, and on a bigger, broader world scale, when you think about also opportunities at the micro level, I mean, I've gone both ways, right? I've gone worldwide on the agritech front, and so that's big and expansive. But we've also gone molecular in terms of the work that we've done on the protein. And so I think there's as much excitement and opportunity in going into the molecules, getting close to the molecule, as my partner Don used to say. And you can think of the opportunities that there will be in the future to grow wonderful, new, useful products and things in the field.
Now, one, I just have a personal interest, very tangential, in Africa. When I started working on this project, I went on eBay because I wanted to gather together old postcards of the grain industry in Thunder Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall coming across a postcard that was from the same era, so it would be around 1910. And juxtapositioning that postcard to a postcard from Thunder Bay, which showed one of the new terminal elevators built in the 1910s, and the storage of grain in Africa, which was the other postcard, which was essentially a pile of grain on the shore of the country. And I thought, now why did that happen? Why in Canada we built this wonderful infrastructure, built up the expertise in building these elevators and maintaining the crop so it didn't get eaten by rodents or destroyed by weather and whatever. And then in Africa, nothing happened. They were piling grain on the shore. And I don't know if I'm just so... I certainly didn't keep up on what happened in Africa. So I'm interested in Africa as a customer and what you learned about that over your time from the 1970s to now, where...
Well, you remember I worked for 2 years in Senegal, West Africa.
No, you didn't mention that on tape, but you did mention
okay.
it where we were
yeah,
speaking
so
before
should,
the
should
interview.
Mention that. So we were there. I was there with my family, and we were there for 2 years, just a little over 2 years, working for the World Food Program. United Nations World Food Program. It was the time of the great drought, yet another great drought in this case West Africa. And so my job was to receive and help distribute food aid from the World Food Program. So that meant that countries like Canada would contribute food, and Norway would contribute food, and the U.S. would food, and Sweden, and then we would receive these shipments and then work with the Senegalese officials to distribute it to the sinistre populations, that were the populations that were in jeopardy, at risk. And we did so either as emergency food aid and also as food for work. So there was part of the payment that was made for work on infrastructure. We didn't have any projects building grain storage, but we did have irrigation projects and other projects directed to food enhancing productivity and food self-sufficiency. But the question as to why the Africans don't have silos and proper storage and everything is a difficult one, and I don't know the answer to it, and I'm not sure anybody else does. But from what I saw, they seem to be just caught in some kind of a trap there that didn't allow them to move very far from where they were. And I sensed in part it was because of a social structural situation whereby the people who were at the top of this social structure, things were working reasonably well for them. They were driving cars and they were doing well, and they had the things they needed. And it really didn't suit them too much to have new varieties of sorghum introduced that would triple, quadruple, and increase dramatically the production of sorghum, which would distort the whole balance between the production of sorghum and the production of the cash crop peanuts. And the peanuts were then exported and could be used to gain foreign currency, and foreign currency could be used to buy the things that certain people found more desirable than others. They could buy anything, of course. But it seemed to me that they were almost in a state of paralysis, that they couldn't move because of this structure. Now, that's very simplistic and just my view from a short time there. However, a lot of people working very hard, trying to do the right thing, international circles, very impressed with Canadian efforts and international efforts to be useful and helpful in that part of the world.
When were you involved in that?
That was set way back in 76, 75, 76, so that's a long time ago.
And how did you come to take part in it?
Well, I attended a lecture, another lecture. I got to be careful not to attend any lectures, but I attended a lecture by George Hutton, who was a former minister, well-regarded minister of agriculture in the province of Manitoba, who at the time had taken a position with the World Food Program and who came back from the World Food Program to Manitoba, gave a presentation, and I was impressed with it, went up to see him afterwards and asked questions, as I did in the earlier story with Don Murray. And one thing led to another. He said, well, we're looking for young fellows like you. Can you speak French? And I said, well, barely. He said, that doesn't matter. We can teach you French, but if you're interested, there's a job for you in West Africa. That appealed to me. And I said, okay, I'll take a look at it. I made arrangements for a leave of absence from the wheat board for a couple of years. They were agreeable, and I went off and spent the 2 years in West Africa. And it was a wonderful experience, and also a feeling of really doing something useful. Now, there are lots of useful things to do in the world, and people do them every day. But that felt very good to be helping directly with that's a very feel-good kind of a situation.
Like.
Yes, that's right.
You took a leave of absence from the wheat board to do this. Did you see connections between what the wheat board was doing and the World Food Program?
Well, the mandates were quite different. One was commercial and the other was international relief. And so the connection was wheat and food. And so that was clear. And the other thing that comes up, of course, is that at one level, when you think about it, if you are giving food away to populations that might otherwise be pushed to buy it. It could affect the markets and supply and demand and commercial reality. But the truth is that there never was enough involved in the food aid compared to the entire size of crops, world crops and trade, to be anything other than marginal. And the populations involved would never have had the resources themselves to be participants in the commercial world of grain. So that's a discussion that we had actually at the Wheat Board with the commissioners at the time about that sort of relationship and impact. And in the end, they seem to be quite different worlds. We didn't cross there. It's not like the food aid was displacing any commercial business, because the commercial business either didn't take place at all or seemed to take place off to the side, was not affected by much at all by the food aid events.
So we have the Agritech experience, the SIGI experience, the Canadian Wheat Board experience, the BURCON and its predecessor, BMW experience. Anything in your career that I've missed?
I think for the active life in the grain industry, that's it. But I think we've pretty well got her covered.
So I have some general questions then.
Yes, yes.
When you look back on a pretty illustrious career, I would say, and I don't say that to everybody, what are you most proud of?
I think I have to, a couple of things. One is that I actually did something. In other words, I didn't just moan about the fact that we seemed to be losing some ground in terms of Canadian content, in terms of the jobs that were available, in terms of the technology. And so I'm quite proud of the fact that we actually put a stake in the ground and said, nope, we're going to try and do something about this. We wanted to create wealth. We had three objectives for our company. One was to create wealth in the sense that you make two blades of grass grow where one grew before. Two was we wanted to add value to Canadian crops. I mean, people have been talking about this, da-da-da-da-da, for the longest time, and some did. And three is we wanted to make good jobs right here in Canada, in these fields. And the fact that we were able to do that and to achieve this platform and this company and this technology center, and we're now working with one of the biggest companies in the world to commercialize our products, and we've got a company trading in a publicly traded market. I think that's something. I feel like we made a little bit of a contribution there. And the other part would be this, we talked about the World Food Program. I really felt very, very good about that. I thought that was a tremendously worthwhile exercise. Probably as much for me as for them. But we did our best, and we established some records and milestones there, being quick to respond to food aid, to food emergencies when people said it was impossible. I don't do impossible well, so I thought, well, no, we're going to do this, and so we found a way to do it. Anyway, that's.
And what was your position there?
I was the World Food Program field officer. So I parachuted in there with a severe language disadvantage, having high school French from Manitoba, and no aspersions on that. It was a fine program, and I did my best, and we came out of it in pretty good shape. But it doesn't really equip you for just getting off an airplane and going straight to a meeting with the Minister of Agriculture and trying to figure out, you know, what we're going to do with the next shipment of this, that, and the other thing that you really weren't too familiar with. So it was interesting. I spent probably 6 weeks in what I describe as a deaf and dumb situation, and eventually came out of that and wound up being able to speak French tolerably well with what I'm called as a horrible accent. But there you go. That's what happened.
Great. Any recollections about Thunder Bay? Did Thunder Bay ever factor in your career?
Well, it was certainly an important part of the supply chain going east into the Atlantic and into the markets that I was responsible for. And there were two avenues from Thunder Bay forward in terms of grain supply. One was that salties would sometimes go up, but with less frequency, to Thunder Bay and take grain directly, not fully loaded, but partly loaded, and then be topped up in the river. So that was, you know, that was part of our whole supply chain going into the UK. And then, of course, it operated essentially as a transfer house, taking grain from rail into the Lakers and then on to either the Maritimes or to the St. Lawrence River. So yes, it was part of our program, but I could see, I think we could all see that everything was shifting. The flow out of Thunder Bay and the advantage that we thought we had with the lakes there seemed to diminish over time, and that all the focus shifted to the West Coast, to Southeast Asia, to Vancouver, and then to Prince Rupert.
Did that create any impact on your work?
No, not really. No, it didn't. I can't think of anything.
I think you've probably covered this in as we went through the various stages of your career. The question is, what were the major changes you saw in your job in the industry over the years?
I think we've covered those, actually.
Mm-hmm. Canada as a competitor, any changes over the years? Up, down, has it pretty much, in your experience, maintained its place in the competitive market, the grain competitive market?
Yes, from what I can see, I think we have maintained our competitive position, but I think we're at the threshold probably of a change there in terms of the Canadian wheat brand. And what I mean by that is that up to now there's always been a strong focus on exemplifying the good quality characteristics of Canadian wheat, and the brand had some value. And the board attempted to use its single desk selling monopoly power to get to obtain premiums for farmers, and were successful in doing so for a long period of time. But that's all changed now. So we now have, I think, a bit of a different situation. And I wonder whether the Canadian brand will continue to be as exonerated as it is. Those now selling Canadian wheat will probably, and quite understandably so, take the view that the Canadian wheat is just one of, if you're an international company, just one of many options to supply a customer with. And the very best situation, I think, for an international supplier would be to say, well, we'll sell you some wheat, and what we would like it to be optional origin, and these are the grades we're offering in Canada, these are the grades that of American wheat we can offer, and this is the one, and we'll ship the ones that work out best for us and for you. So I think there might be a change there in how Canadian wheat finds its way to market, how it's presented, how it's marketed. Maybe more of it's going to be as part of an optional origin package by international sellers.
This, I guess, is tied in with changes that have occurred in the industry per se, and I don't know whether you want to make comments on the changes since 2000, which were pretty big ones in the industry.
No, but you know, I guess we have to acknowledge there's been a very big change in terms of how wheat is marketed, and that the Canadian Wheat Board is no longer the single desk marketer of Canadian wheat. And now there are other players directly involved in buying wheat directly from farmers and selling it. And I guess we remains to be seen what the significance of that that's going to be. But I guess over time we've seen the disappearance of the pools. So Manitoba Pool, Sask Pool, Alberta Pool gone, UGG gone, and then their successor Viterra now taken over by a much larger international company, part of the whole globalization exercise. And maybe more at the farmer level, I'm wondering if there isn't a shift in thinking too as well. Whereas the pools represented farmers working together, cooperating as it were, in the marketing of their grain and then also in buying in inputs and supplies and so on, that seemed to be a model that worked well for them over the years. But that's all shifted now, and people now, I think, are a little more independently minded, and they prefer to do their own marketing and to run their own operations, and perhaps less inclined to that cooperative model. So I think that's been a shift over time.
This is a slightly different question than challenges and changes. This is most significant events that happened during your time on the job. So these are sort of like the stars that pop out and say, yes, I'll always remember that, or I'll always remember that, that occurred.
Well, one must certainly be the changes at the Canadian Wheat Board. Who would ever have thought that the Canadian Wheat Board, that at one time virtually controlled the Canadian grain industry? Wheat was the biggest crop. It was only marketed by the Wheat Board. The board allocated cars for board and non-board and essentially ran everything, together with its agents, of course, but I mean they were the drivers in all of this. That they would essentially, they haven't disappeared, but that their role would be substantially changed to the point where they are now probably, we could say, one of the smaller players in the industry. And who knows how that's going to unfold. That chapter remains to be written. So that has to be one of the major changes that took place. And the other thing is to think about the handling system, the changes that have taken place there. From several thousand country elevators, small wooden country elevators, in the space of my lifetime, being replaced by 100, is it now? I'm not sure of the number of...
More like 200 and some across
200
the
and some inland terminals. And so, I mean, it's quite a fantastic change. Mm-hmm. And so one has to think, and it's connected to all sorts of other changes, right, including communications, including increases in productivity, equipment, fertilizer, genetics, all of this stuff moving forward at a tremendous pace.
Very hard to have predicted. Was there, you know, you were in the industry, were these all predictable things? It's just that... they seem to take forever to come, and then all of a sudden
all of a sudden the floodgates come open up, don't they? So what were some of the floodgates opening up? One, I guess, maybe was the free trade agreement, which shortly after that we had change in ownership structure and in participation in the Canadian grain industry, and milling and malting and more participation from outside. From other countries, other companies based in other countries. So that has to be, you know, a floodgate kind of an opening change. What else happened? I mean, I can think of my UK experience. Obviously, the Common Agricultural Policy and the very high import tariffs just dramatically changed the situation for us in Europe. So we were kind of forced to look elsewhere, and happily, at the time, Southeast Asia opened up and other market opportunities appeared. So that was a big shift.
Transportation. The end of the crow's nest, the thinking about Canadian companies who have become more multinational, the CN and the CP.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. So that's a good point. Yes, that's part of the change, isn't it? And who knows, you know, what came first and what came second here? What's the cause and effect? But I suppose the changes in the railway situation, yes, created the opportunity for better freight rates, for bigger facilities that could load 54 cars, and they had 8 hours in which to do that, and then even bigger facilities now, and that predicated and resulted in the dramatic change in the country elevator system, and that came out of the change of the Crow's Nest Pass rates, of course. Yes, that's true. That's true. That's all part of it.
Hmm. And the future will be interesting. Both the in the industries that you're still involved in, and
yes, and you ask whether there were any signs that this was coming. I suppose there were signs, but did any of us see them? I'm not sure we did. And so when we stand here and look forward, what do we see now?
Mm-hmm.
I see huge opportunities for young people. I mean, I think we're going to have, this is a great time to be in agriculture, in my opinion. And if I were doing it again, and I am still doing it, but at a different, from a slightly different profession, I wouldn't hesitate to jump into our business. I think it's exciting, dynamic, full of opportunity.
And probably a lot more people following your route in being involved around the world. So they may get their education, they may grow up in Winnipeg and get their education in Winnipeg, but they, given the global nature of the industry, are unlikely, unless they choose to, stay.
It's true, and one can see at the moment opportunities in Southeast Asia. And so a young person perhaps would be well advised to go to Southeast Asia, have a look around, see what's there, and get plugged into economies that are growing, that are moving ahead.
And many of them are, because they couldn't get jobs here, so they go there and they teach.
Yes,
but
yes, they do.
And they learn the language, and that opens doors for them.
That's a huge benefit, absolutely.
Now, I have a self-serving question, which I will also continue after the interview. But I mentioned to you when we were speaking off tape that our... super goal is to set up a national historic site in Thunder Bay related to the grain elevators,
mm-hmm.
recognizing their part in the growth of Canada as a international grain trader against geographic odds in the initial stages. And if we are successful in doing that, what parts of that you see from your career would you like to see displayed there, covered there? What would you like visitors from Canada and from the world who pass through to know about? The Wheat Board, the Canadian International Grains Institute, the companies that supply silos and whatever?
Well, I'm interested in the story. I think it is fascinating, and it would be it will be, I'm sure, a rich ground for research in the future, and is probably done. To think about the changes that have taken place during my lifetime, It would be interesting to have, it seems to me, and useful and worthwhile to have that recorded somewhere. Not my lifetime, not my story, but the big story. And that would be, I'd like to see that. But in terms of one particular thing, like do I have a whiz-banger that I think should be in there or not? No, I really don't. But you know, you can think of the focus, the orientation was all towards Europe and the UK and all of that, including the varieties, including Thunder Bay, including that whole Eastern export program. And then that all shifted, and it shifted for the reasons we've talked about, and then it all shifted to the West Coast and the Southeast Asian markets.
Now, we'll talk more about that because not only, we'll talk more about that off tape. Other people that we should interview?
Well, you've probably spoken to Bob Rowley. I would hope so, mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's a wellspring of...
I think he probably gave me your name.
He may well have done that.
Yeah.
Hey, Bob and I are old friends, and we work together, mm-hmm. and we're still in contact. And yes, good that you.
What about,
and you, and certainly Brian Olson, you would have spoken to him.
No, I haven't. But I was trying to contact him this week, and we've sort of ships passing in the night. So
okay.
I'll have to pick him up at another time. What about the brewing side of things?
Now, who would be a good person to speak to on that? You know, there's a guy, Norm Kendall, but he's been out of the business for a while. But he would also. I wonder if he wouldn't be. He's a reflective kind of philosophical guy, but only he's not in Winnipeg, he's in Neepawa, so that's
oh, is he?
Too
okay.
far away.
Nope, that's not too far away, and I have friends, farmers in Neepawa that I can just mooch off of.
Okay, well, he's right at the corner of Highway 5 and 357.
Well, that's great, because his name was given to me, and nobody knew where he was.
I know where he is. And because I bumped into him, and
okay.
he, and what happens is, if you go up Highway Number 5 towards, I guess Dauphin, it would be at that point, Neepawa Number 5. You go about 12 or 15 miles north, and then 357 is called the Mountain Road, and it goes west at that point. If you drive 1 mile, maybe 1.5, no more, and you start to rise, on the right-hand side, the north side, you will see an old. You will see a sculpture. It's supposed to be a sculpture. It's an old broken down pump thing from a long time ago, and that's his stuff. That's his sign. I don't know why he chose that for his sign. That's him. But then he's tucked in there on an acreage. He lives right there. Got a wonderful garden. Deer running all over the place. Deer season ended yesterday, so he'll be happy to see you. And. I think he would be a great guy to talk to because he went through. He came here. He's a Brit who came here a long time ago, and he worked in the brewing industry. He was head of the National Association. No, I'm thinking of the British and Irish National Association of British and Irish Millers, with whom I worked for many years in the UK. But he was head of an organization that was sort of an umbrella organization for the brewing industry. And he did. He's got two barley varieties named after him. One Norm, and the other Kendall, I think. And so he would be a really good guy to talk to.
Good. And the noodle side.
The noodle side. I was going to say Paul Chen, and that's because Paul Chen was the first guy to head up the noodle section, the noodle department at the Grains Institute. And I can give you his number if you want to call him in Vancouver.
Paul
Chen, C-H-E-N. So he knows all about, but he probably is the guy who knows too much about noodles. He's, I think, a Chinese or perhaps a Taiwanese national who came and worked with us. One other person, probably Denny Stevens. Have you spoken to
yes.
Denny Stevens?
Yeah.
Because Denny is not short of observations on the grain industry. And most of them very good. All of them very good.
Okay. Looking for somebody who is sort of technical. So would Paul be the
Tony
guy?
Tweed?
I'm trying to get hold of him. He's not. He doesn't have a telephone answering.
No, he doesn't. Have you got his email?
No.
Here it is.
He thought he could escape me.
No, you want to talk to Tony.
I've talked to him when he was at Siggy, because, but we usually waited till people retired, and I noticed he just retired.
Yeah, but you know what? He'll have time.
Good.
Okay, so here, I'm just going to get this for you. Option, propose email to Tony, T-O-N-Y, Tony Tweed, there he is. Here's his address. Why is he? He's T Tweed.
Well, no, let me
Tweed Tony.
Well, let me just end off the interview.
Sorry.
And
yes,
so that we don't have his email address
in the middle of it all. Yes.
In the middle of it all. So, anything I haven't asked that I should have asked you that you were hoping? Gee, I hope she asks me about this.
No, I think I'm quite comfortable with what we've covered, and there's really. Nothing more that I can think of to add right now.
Okay, thanks. Well, you have my email address, so if you think I want another session, just let me know. So I'm just going to sign off now with my thanks for quite a wonderful couple of hours covering your career.